the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben. This is Johnny. Johnny, how are you this week?
Yeah, I'm doing not bad this week. Had a nice relaxing weekend. How about yourself?
Very well, thank you. Yes, no J1 on the docket, of course, in this podcast, as the top league in Japan had the weekend off with the national team in action. Well, we thought they were going to be in action twice, but only the once, as it pans out. And to help us run through all of the ramifications of what's been going on with the Japan national team and their games against North Korea, it's one of our old friends, Scott McIntyre, making a very welcome return to J-Talk. Scott, how are you?
I'm okay, Mr. Maxwell. I have a question. Why have you dropped your surnames this year? It's Ben and Johnny. You sound like an ice cream brand.
Yeah, just decided to shake things up and see if anybody noticed. Scott, you happened to be the first one. So thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, change is as good as a holiday, as you know.
That's it. Yeah, no, it's great to be back on. I'm happy to. And congratulations as well, Johnny. You've been doing a really good job stepping in for Sam.
Thank you very much.
All right then, Scott. So, we thought we'd have you on when we'd be recording on Tuesday night after Japan played the second of their World Cup qualifiers against North Korea. But, as I kind of teased in a roundabout way, in a fairly ordinary way in the intro, the game on Tuesday night is not taking place. So I guess before we dive in on what's happened last Thursday night at the National Stadium, what can you tell us about the situation about why this game was cancelled and what it will mean for both of these nations down the road?
Well, as is often the case with North Korea, nobody really knows. My understanding is that they came out with this a rather curious excuse that there's some, virus that's going around Japan, which is a legitimate thing, but it's, only impacted, I think, kind of a number of people you can count on two hands. But they said, they didn't want to risk this then coming back into North Korea, despite the fact that they just sent a 40-person delegation to the actual country in question on the exact day that they'd made the complaint. So it kind of doesn't add up. Yeah, my understanding is that it's being discussed in FIFA as to what will happen now. And I guess what will happen is that Japan will be awarded the points, and I suppose there might be some kind of punishment, you would think, coming the way of North Korea, because it doesn't surprise anyone, right, really, that this was kind of going to happen. I actually really tossed up. I've been waiting to get into North Korea for such a long time. I really heavily tossed up about going to this, but then I forgot the deadline to apply for the applications, which is a good thing, because all these people, that's the thing, like there's a bunch of small problems and everything else, but there were a bunch of journos and that were planning to go over, that's been cancelled and everything else. So yeah, it's a shame, but what we know is that the game is it's not been postponed, it's been cancelled full stop, so it won't be played. The only logical conclusion to draw from that is that Japan will get the points and North Korea will get some kind of punishment as a result.
Yeah, really strange turn of events, Johnny. As Scott says, basically while the game was being played, news had leaked out that, the North Koreans weren't going to be able to host the game on Tuesday. And it would have been, I think I'm right in saying, the first international football match that they've hosted since COVID-19 struck. So, I guess there might be a number of reasons behind the scenes about why it's been cancelled. But I guess from a slightly selfish point of view, I'm disappointed, because it would have been a fascinating occasion, and I know it wasn't going to be shown live on TV in Japan, but whatever images we could have gotten from the game at a later time, I think would have been fascinating to see.
I think you said off air last week that something like the North Koreans, that they march to their own beat, or something along those kind of lines. And I think that was a bit very apt. We'll never really know the true reasons for the game being cancelled. I mean, it is fascinating that it happened during the game that essentially announced that, because I only heard it after the game, and I sort of automatically assumed, well, if they were winning, or they were going to, if they'd won the game, would they then have actually continued to play the game in Pyongyang? Like, what was the point in that? The last time Japan played over there was 2011, which is before I was even in Japan. So I was kind of looking back in the history of the fixture, and Japan have got a pretty rough record over there. So I don't think Moriyasu will be too disappointed that the game is not taking place, and they can sort of cruise through now for a few months without any real challenges. But yeah, absolutely, it would have been a fascinating encounter. And it's a bit of a waste the fact that they only had one game and they didn't play the likes of Kubo or Nagatomo came back into the squad, but he didn't get a run out. But I guess in the long run, that Japan are not really the losers. It's North Korea that I think have lost out from all this whole scenario.
Of course, I should say, Ben, the other scenario is, depending on, you know, if there is going to be a punishment for North Korea for this, and say, for example, they got kicked out of the whole thing, the other option instead of just awarding the win to Japan, of course, is just to null all the results involving North Korea up to this point. So, I mean, either way, you would think, I mean, they're going to finish top of a three-team group with Syria and Myanmar in it.
Absolutely. Yes, indeed. So, obviously, there's still more to come out about this. And obviously, the end result of things, whether Japan do ultimately get awarded the 3 points and if there is any punishment for North Korea. But yes, we would expect both of those things to happen in due course. All right, then. So last Thursday night, Japan hosted North Korea at the National Stadium in Tokyo. It was, ultimately a 1-0 victory for the Samurai Blue, but it wasn't smooth sailing, I think it's safe to say. Although, coming in on the back of 5-0 victories in each of their first two qualifiers against Syria and Myanmar, when Al Tanaka struck in the second minute, Scott, it looked like the floodgates were going to open in a very familiar territory.
Yes, but I think certainly, yeah, I mean, we can go into detail and things in a minute, but attack-wise, they offered almost nothing, the North Koreans, about as much attacking threat as their nuclear weapons program. But defensively, they were pretty good, you know. I mean, they were well-organized, a kind of a, you know, block of four, two in front, kind of compact, very hard to play through. So they caused problems for Japan in you know, the ability of Japan to be able to break them down. So they didn't offer anything going forward. Japan weren't really tested defensively at all. But yeah, as you say, okay, you think the early goal things might have opened up, but credit to North Korea, they remained fairly well organized and frustrated and stifled Japan. This is a problem that Japan have long had in how to break down these kind of teams. Maybe we can get into that in a little bit more detail. But yeah, it certainly didn't play out the way over the 90 that you thought it might have given that early start.
Yeah, and Johnny, I mean, it probably should have been 3 or 4 by halftime. I mean, Richard Doan had a number of chances that it must be said, yeah, the keeper, North Korean keeper Jang Ju-hyuk was very much on the top form and kept out a couple of chances from Doan that, yeah, he would have expected to score, no question. But, the start of the second half, I think, Johnny, we almost had an international incident after North Korea had the ball in the net. I think it was the second minute or the third minute of the second half, but the referee had blown for a foul on Hiroki Ito after a shot from distance had been tipped onto the post by Zion Suzuki. So, yeah, the warning signs were there early on in the second half for Japan, and I think it's safe to say that they failed to heed them, because North Korea did have a period of looking fairly ominous there for a while, and Japan were very nervy at times in the second half.
Yeah, so, I mean, full disclosure to all the listeners, I only caught the highlights of the first half, and then I saw the whole of the second half. So, you know, it seemed like from the first half, I think North Korea didn't have a single shot on goal. And like you said, the goalkeeper made a few good saves. And there's another couple of times, I think, the way the bounce of the ball just went the wrong way for a Japanese point of view. So, you know, 1-0 at halftime, it's still a very much a live game. And then exactly as you said, after that chance, that really seemed to give the North Koreans a bit of hope. And I felt like, you know, the Japan attack, that the front four, Minamino and Ueda, I think they looked lost and kind of playing too far apart from each other at times. Doan seemed to lose effectiveness as the game went on. And the only one that really impressed me in the second half was Maeda down the left. And I think you could really, you know, we've talked about the kind of depth Japan have. And, you know, it's amazing to have players like, you know, from Feyenoord or Monaco, or the German Bundesliga, Celtic is your front four. But you could see the kind of the missing the pace down the flank of a Mitoma or Junya Ito, or even, you know, the Kubo and Nakamura, I assume, could have played in this game, but they were being kind of kept back for the game that was supposed to be played on Tuesday. So that front four really just didn't work for me. I think they brought on Wataru Endo during the second half, and that definitely helped them to kind of gain control of the midfield, which was a battle they were in danger of losing a bit. And then, you know, towards the back end, I think the North Koreans, you know, they're not really exposed enough a lot of high level international competition, especially in recent years, and that they kind of, once they didn't get that goal, they kind of ran out of steam, and Japan started creating more chances, and then when it went into that kind of 3-4-2-1, I was a bit surprised. But what is Moriyasu doing, kind of bringing on Taniguchi? But it did actually seem to kind of stabilize the shape, and I think that in tandem with North Korea tiring, it looked like Japan could have got a goal late on. But I mean, yeah, the way that those two kind of 5-0 results were obviously pre-Asian Cup, and that Japan were absolutely flying last year. Everything they touched turned to gold. And then, yeah, this is a bit of a hangover, I think, after the Asian Cup. And Moriyasu, like we said, after the Asian Cup, he was in a very strong position going in, but he's obviously been wounded by that, and maybe he's a bit cautious here. I mean, Scott, I know you said in the green room you didn't really want to talk about Moriyasu too much, but what did you think about his tactical approach to this game and his general standing with the national team?
Yeah, you're right. I think the Asian Cup has changed things, and for me the other thing that really changed it was the comments of Hidemasa Morita after they went out of that tournament, which were really pointed. Very unusual for a Japanese player at any level to be coming out and making those kind of comments. So the first thing that surprised me was that, yeah, he was straight back into the 11 tonight. You know, that could have gone either way. I don't think he was particularly good. The pressure and the heat's on, because there was, you know, there were voices externally and you know, I've been quite critical of the guy even with the results, because I don't think they're playing to their capacity, and certainly that group, I mean, they should have won the Asian Cup. There's absolutely no question. And I think Moriyasu had a large part of the blame should be apportioned to him that they didn't. So what did he do here tonight? It was kind of as you were. The switch to a back three in the last 15 minutes really confused me, because I don't think these are the kind of decisions. You know, if it's a friendly against, you know, some random African nation in, you know, in September or whatever, before, you know, months before a tournament, I kind of, you know, understand it. But you're coming off what happened in the Asian Cup, and I don't think these kind of large-scale tactical shifts within a game should be happening at international level, simply because you don't have time to work on them in training. So, you know, if he's working on the way that he set them up to play, whatever we call it, a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3, whatever your definition of it is, you know, you've got maybe a session or two to work on that. You've literally had no time to work on this shift to a three, which, you know, a lot of the players obviously don't play there at club level and everything else. So I'm not a massive fan in international football of these kind of, you know, really strict you know, kind of tactical shifts within the game. Then we, you know, we can question the individuals within it. You know, I think he obviously likes Corky Machida because you've got a left-footed central defender, so it kind of balances things. I didn't think he was good. The problem at left back, it's not going away by continuing to play. The problem at left back, and then he's become really, really reliant. The way that I gotta quit. This is not a quiz question with a right or wrong answer, but for me, my reading of this and the way that he really wants to play and the way that the team is playing, I reckon there's one player who's the most important player to the way that he wants them to play. Do you want to have a guess who that is? Who was in the 11 here?
Minamino?
No.
Tanaka?
No, no, I reckon who's actually been really, really good for him the last couple of games is Esdaye Maeda, and the question for me is where you play him, because he played him, you know, out on the left, and he hasn't. But when I say he's the most important for the way that the team wants to play, it's because of all of what he does off the ball. He obviously has some kind of quality on the ball, but the amount of times that Japan won possession back in this game and indeed at the end of the Asian Cup as well through Maeda, for me, this guy is an elite off the ball footballer. You know, we can debate his qualities on the ball creatively, but But you know, his initial speed off the burst, the ability he's got to shut down play, to cut off passing lanes, and to consistently win the ball back is exactly what a Moriyasu team needs. And he doubled up, you know, by bringing Asano on and playing both of them kind of, you know, in the 2-10 role for the last 15 minutes as well. So it's clearly such an important element is winning possession back quickly. You know, again, we can discuss then when they're on the ball what they're doing with it. But the way that he's got the team playing, I think Maeda is close now to an indispensable member of this team. You think that role wide on the left is Mitoma's when he's fit and available. So the question is, what does he do with Maeda? Would play Maeda as a nine? I'm not really particularly impressed with Ayase Wade either on the ball or certainly not off it. They're completely different players. Like I said, Maeda for me is in the top handful of players globally in the ability to harass Harry and constantly win possession back. And I think Japan are a far poorer team off the ball, and certainly the way Moriyasu wants to play, if he's not in it. So the question is, yeah, where do you play him going forward? I would play him through the middle as a nine if he's going to persist with this. But yeah, I didn't like the tactical switch for the last 15 minutes. But the thing is, we don't really know what was going to happen. Of course, I don't think Zion Suzuki, you know, he's not Japan's number one keeper either. He wasn't really tested in this, but there were a couple of times, you know, he kind of plays nice passes, you know, three and four and four or five, but the one that he doesn't hurts them a lot. There was a moment, I think, late in the first half where he just, with no pressure at all, he just punted it, you know, out the touchline. So these are the kind of mistakes that you can get away with against this level of opposition. But we saw, obviously what happened at the Asian Cup. And I think that's a huge issue, the keeping problem. The left back is a massive problem. Again, if Japan had a coach that liked to look outside of the, you know, the first tier of certain things, you know, he could go to Shimizu and look at Japan's left back, who should have been there 2 years ago. And he certainly should be there now. He started very, very well this season as well. Two goals in six games as well, and that's Rayon Yamahara, who for me is clearly Japan's left back of the present and of the future. But with this coach, we know that he probably won't be picking him, and so we get stuck with a guy who was in J2 3-4 years ago as is now Japan's current left back. So there's issues within the personnel, there's issues within the tactical adjustments in game, but none of it matters ultimately at this point of the tournament, because you're meeting opposition that you're better than and you're going to get through. But the issues will be when you get through to that third round of qualification, and then, yeah, the tests become a lot harder.
Yes, very well said, Scott. Okay, so it was, uncomfortable at times in the second half for Japan, and, yes, it did necessitate that switch to a back three, and also saw Daiki Hashioka get a run out after Yukinari Sugawara was kicked off the pitch by the North Koreans as they, tired and, got increasingly aggressive towards the end of the game. But, yeah, Japan unable to kill it off with a second goal, but in the end, Al Tanaka's second-minute goal proved to be the difference between the sides. All right, then. So before we wrap up the national team chat, the under-23s have also been in action over the course of this international break, playing two friendlies against nations who have already qualified for the Paris Olympics in Mali and Ukraine. The Mali game was lost 3-1 by the junior samurai, but tonight on Monday, they have defeated Ukraine by 2-0. And, what's to come, Scott? You were filling I'm pretty sure Johnny's well aware of this, but you were filling in me especially about what's to come for the under-23s in their Asian Cup / Paris qualification tournament that's coming up soon.
Yeah, a couple of weeks away over in Qatar. Everything's happening in Qatar before everything starts to happen in Saudi Arabia. So there's 16 nations in that tournament. Japan are in a group with South Korea, the UAE and China. Top two in each group through to the quarters, and then the winners of that are either direct through to the Olympics or in the playoff spot. So there's three, of course, only 16 nations in the Olympics, the men's tournament. So three automatic, the two semifinal winners and the winner of the third place match and the loser of that. So fourth in the Asian Cup has a playoff against Guinea. All the other confederations have done their qualification, so it's only Asia left to go. And, yeah, so Mali and Ukraine, obviously, as you said, both already qualified for the Olympics. So good test for Japan. Going to be a really tight, I think, qualification process. There's a tournament over in Saudi Arabia at the moment, the West Asian Under-23 Championships. I think almost half The teams in the AFC under-23s are over there. Australia made it through to the final. They'll play tomorrow against South Korea in that. So I think a lot of the heavyweights opted to go over there and kind of play each other in a kind of pre-Asian Cup hit-out. Japan opted to stay here and play these two friendlies against the nations that have already qualified. So, yeah, it should be a great tournament. And yeah, looking forward to seeing which three or four of those Asian nations get through to the Olympics.
It'll be interesting to see as well that the makeup of that squad, because I know for these two friendlies, I think there was four FC Tokyo players in the squad, and obviously no games were missed, but this AFC tournament will take place while J1 is in a very busy spell of play. So whether they have any constraints in having to balance out which teams they take players from.
No. There's no cap on teams. But what I believe, because they're not, like I said, it's not in a FIFA window. So I think they've already kind of internally got the squad. It hasn't been named, but I don't think there's too many European guys in there because, you know, their clubs won't release them. So I think there's going to be a lot of J-League clubs missing, some kind of key players during that 2-3 weeks in late April.
Yeah, that's so good. All right. But obviously we do wish the under-23s all the best. And we'll be following their progress throughout the under-23 Asian Cup. And hope they can seal a spot to the Paris Olympics. All right, then. So that's our national team chat taken care of on this week's episode. We will take a very short break. And on the other side of that, Scott will help us summarize the first 4 weeks of the new J1 season.
Boom, ba-da, boom, ba-da, boom, boom, boom.
Welcome back. And in part two of this week's podcast, we'll just run the rule over the first four match days of the J1 season and pick out a few teams who have perhaps disappointed us to this point of the campaign. Obviously, very, very early doors, and we're still in overreaction theatre territory, and also some that have pleasantly surprised through the first month or so of the new campaign. So, Scott, I mean, it'd be tempting to just look at the table and say, you know, four or five of the bottom six teams have been disappointing to this point. But obviously, there are factors involved, like, you know, the schedules that each team have had through to this point. Some have had much easier fixture lists than others through the first month. But if you were to pick out a couple of teams that have disappointed you, let you down from your preseason expectations to this point, who would you plump for?
Well, I had Nagoya finishing second. They're currently sale third last, so that fits that criteria very well. Like you say, there have been factors. Obviously, you know, it was a massive amount of change. Basically, the entire back three from what it was the satellite season had gone at Grampus. You know, they brought players in. Some didn't weren't available to start early on. Some still aren't available to start. So, you know, so there's issues. But you could see the frustration after one of the goals they copped, who do they play? Niigata before the break. You could see the frustration from Mitch Langerak. You know, it's like, geez, you know, I've had the best kind of defense in Japan, and I've gone to these, these kind of jokers that aren't anywhere near the same level. So that's hurt Nagoya. Obviously, Junker's been in and out. Yamagishi was an absolutely fantastic off-season signing. Hasn't been fully fit yet either. So there's factors behind Grampus, but sitting where they are on whatever it is, three losses and the one win from the four games, that's not I would have had that flipped. So they've been disappointing. Sapporo, I think I actually had them in my J-Pred in the bottom three. So they've been disappointing, sure, but I think we maybe need to ask questions about the direction of the club, the coaching and everything else. And like you said, you can't just look at the bottom, because Verdi have been the specialists in copying 90 plus minute goals, but they've actually been quite all right so far. And then above, you know, Kawasaki have had flashes. I think they've been really good going forward, but obviously huge issues defensively, which they've always had. But you know, for me, if you want to pull out a handful of ones that have been disappointing through whatever it is, only four games, I think Nagoya clearly, and maybe Sapporo. And actually, can I say Reds as well? I think obviously the going through the whole process of having to come in with a new coach, tactically readjusting things again. Sol Barker and a few of the other kind of opposition key off-season signings, Maida wasn't fit for the first couple of games as well. So they maybe haven't had their 11, but neither is that a problem unique to them. But, you know, maybe they've got a little bit more of of a leeway of excuse in terms of the tactical changes and some of the personnel ones as well. I think that, again, it's only four matches, but maybe they haven't hit the ground running quite as much as we would have thought they would. But yeah, if we're going to pick just a couple, Nagoya, Sapporo, and then Reds.
Yeah, but basically I almost fully overlapped with you. I'd written down like Nagoya, Sapporo, Kawasaki, because yeah, I had Nagoya and Kawasaki my top six in my prediction, so that they've obviously, neither of them have really lived up to expectations. I think, yeah, Erison being out injured has really hurt Kawasaki, and they also, it seems a bit like Oniki is desperate to try and put the best players on the field rather than the best players to fit into the system. He's sort of jamming too many attack-minded midfielders in there. And yes, Sapporo, I kind of had them in the bottom half somewhere. And yeah, I think they're the one I'm most worried about. I can kind of see Nagoya and Kawasaki both to some degree, kind of, I know it's very early days, like Scott says, to some degree pulling out of their slump. But Sapporo, you know, if you were to press me in this very early stage, they would be the one I'd be most worried about. I think the next game, they haven't won a game. Next game is Vissel Kobe away. And then, you know, if I think Grampus play Marinos this weekend, and then it's like there's three match days, I think, in the next week. So basically there's three games in 8 or 9 days. And then the following game is Sapporo against Grampus. So that'll be a very interesting game if Sapporo and Nagoya both go down this weekend. But yeah, they're just not creating chances like they used to. And it seems very much like the, you know, worst players trying the same stuff that they've been trying for the last 4 or 5 years. So yeah, still very early days, but they would be the one I'd pick out the most disappointing, the one I'm most worried about not really getting it right.
Can I jump in and ask an extension to that then? Who do you think will be the first? Because I mean, it's perhaps not even too early during this run of Golden Week games to think which coaches might be on the hot seat in terms of, and Sapporo is the big one, right? Because Petrovic has been there for such a long time. And I agree, just some of the decisions are really curious. I mean, he brought Suzuki in as the big kind of marquee signing, didn't start him for the first couple of games. You've got probably your best, in my opinion, the best two attacking threats that they've got, which are Superchok, who, you know, there must be some allergy to not starting these Thai guys until they're in their fifth season in the J-League, but he's an unbelievably, he's one of the best players in Sapporo. He's one of the best creative players in the J-League, full stop, and he can't get into the Sapporo team. And then you've got Asano playing basically, you know, the wide right role in this 3-4-2-1. So if I'm in charge, I have Superchok and Asano with the two kind of guys running it. And you've got Komai maybe deeper when he's better served further forward. The things just seem a little bit messed up. And I know they've had injuries as well with a couple of players. Obviously, they were down to their third choice keeper and stuff. But for me, I just don't know if it hasn't run its course with Petrovic, because the players are there to be doing better than they have, but the question is how long do they hold on, and then what happens to some of these other clubs that maybe are struggling as well or not living up to expectations. Johnny, if you had to put your neck on the line, who do you think will be the first club to pull the trigger?
So it's a very, very good question, because I know pre-season I think we identified Poyatos at Gamba, Popovic at Kashima, and Hasegawa at Nagoya has been the three most likely before the season started. And obviously Poyatos and Popovic have got a couple of results to kind of get their teams going. So that leaves me with Hasegawa. And then, yeah, Petrovic sitting bottom of the league, one goal scored in four games, what, 1 point. I would probably go for Hasegawa to be, I think Nagoya's hopes before the season started would have been higher. So if they don't turn things around sharpish, I think, yeah, Golden Week, he's in his third season there. I think, yeah, if they're still in the bottom three come Golden Week, I think there's been a very serious conversation had. Petrovic, yes, yeah, it's one of these things, again, not a lot of information really comes out from Sapporo as to what they actually expect. Are they happy just finishing in mid-table every year? Because they haven't really, players have left, like exciting young players have left, and they haven't really been replaced. And I think there's only so long you can go on sort of living on past glories from your youth team and universities and just sort of replacing them with players that other teams didn't want. And the first four games of this season has been a bit of a culmination of that policy. But with Misha Petrovic, you also have the problem of his system and way of playing being so unique. And it's been done that for that long at Sapporo. Like, you would almost, you couldn't bring in a coach now that would play a, like, where are the players to play a flat back four, or like go like 4-4-2 or 4-2-3-1 or something? You'd almost have to bring someone in that's similar to him, but not him.
You've got players, right? You like the kid they got from Biokamara, what's his name? Kondo. yeah, you could play him at right back. Okay, maybe left back is a bit of a problem, but the problem that I'm seeing is that my reading of it is that he's not utilizing the players that he does have in their best position. So if we're in this position, the results aren't coming, the goals aren't coming, and you've got these kind of players being shuffled around into roles that they're maybe not best suited for, I wouldn't mind someone coming in and shaking something up. Yeah, you might need to get a left back in to figure it out. Probably I reckon Kondo can play it at right back, no problem whatsoever. And then, you know, the other guys are there to, you know, you can fit them into whatever it is, a 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1, 4-4-2, whatever you want. I think the players are there. Maybe left back is the only issue. So, you know, he's an icon of Japanese football, right? And that's the thing. He's an icon in a way of a club because he's been there. He must be one of the longest serving coaches, I would think, now in J1 at the current club he's at as well. So he's a likable guy. But, geez, you wouldn't want to go down this year as well. And, you know, the way that the quality that there is in J2 as well, it might be a long way back. So I think clubs will probably move maybe earlier than we've seen. Well, certainly last year we didn't see much movement at all. So, I think he's got to be high up the list unless they turn things around. But,
can I throw one back at you, Scott? Toru Uniki at Kawasaki, another J1 icon. How much length has he got at Kawasaki, do you think, if things continue to go particularly poorly?
Well, I don't have a problem because, you made the point trying to throw too many attacking players into the team. For me, that's never a problem. He can play a couple of them at centre-half if he wants. He's living and dying by a philosophy that's had success. You know, like we're talking about Petrovic, who's never, you know, really done anything in terms of title success. But Oniki has won a bunch of stuff. You know, and he's sticking with his philosophy. He's trying to regenerate a team that needs constant regeneration, continuing to ignore the problems at the back. I think going forward, they look really, really good. And if, you know, if they're going to be involved in 5-4 kind of thrillers every week, I say more for it. It's kind of what the J League needs. And I don't think you make a move on Niki because they're, you know, going forward, they're still playing good. Okay, they're going to have defensive problems, but they've had defensive problems for ages. So, you know, if they can. The other thing is I actually went to the Super Cup preseason. A few of these Brazilians that, you know, the thing with Oniki that frustrates me is he brings in these Brazilians that look amazing and then he doesn't kind of integrate them into the team until the second or third season. He's done it consistently. So this Zé Ricardo and what's the young winger?
Patrick
Verhon. You know, they both look really, really good, but we've hardly seen them in the J-League. So he's got great quality in the squad and he's got them playing really good football going forward. And, if I was a Frontale fan, I know Neil Devnam's not a massive take on him, but I think, I think if Neil maybe saw the other side of the coin that they weren't getting results and they weren't playing, at least positive football that led to a lot of goals, I think he might be even more grumpy than he already is. So I think as long as they're still, creating, as long as they're still scoring, they're going to be right up there at the end of the season. I don't see any problems for Aniki unless, he wants to go and maybe take over from our mate the Bowl at the head of the national team.
All right, then. So, the two managers that Johnny and Scott have just been chatting about, Toru Uniki and Miša Petrović, the two most experienced in J1 at their current clubs. Yeah, Scott pointed it out before that Petrović might be the longest serving at his current club. Well, Uniki took over at Kawasaki in 2017 and, Petrović, it was 2018, wasn't it? And when he took them up to fourth in the table. So let's finish on a high note then, guys. There's a couple of obvious teams that I'm sure we would all reference if we're talking about teams that have pleasantly surprised us through the first four rounds of games. But Scott, I'm sure you've got a pre-season call of yours that you'd like to gloat about our current leaders, Machida Zelvia.
Well, Ben, you see, the advantage of making 25,000 pre-season calls is that you might land on one. eventually. I had this argument with Sean actually in person in pre-season. I said, I think Machida are really kind of total dark horses. And he said, get out of here. So I've been reminding him of that regularly. But I did write a piece and put this on the public domain as well that I think they are. title Dark Horses. In years past, I would be really upset by Matsuda being top of the table, but I'm actually not, because the league has become really familiar in terms of trying to play the kind of football that I like. And this team is such a throwback that we don't see in the J-League anymore, like almost at all. So, which was one of the reasons that I thought they might actually really make a great go of it, because I think stylistically they almost stand alone in terms of playing kind of brutal, 1960s Soviet era football. A lot of stuff built on physicality, and I referenced a few quotes that I dug out on the coach Go Kurore in that piece that I wrote for the Asian Game, which were really illuminating. You know, he had whatever it was, 20 odd years up at Aomori Yamato, and he's written a couple of books, and in there he described the kind of methods and routines, and you guys both work in the education system in Japan, so you've probably seen it as well in terms of some of the discipline and structure that can be imposed. So he had players out there, for those outside Japan that don't know, the north of Japan where the high school is located is very, very tough in winter, and he had players out there in snow. He was saying, 60 players out there in knee-high snow playing these games. So, and then, so obviously the physical element of is very, very important. It has been throughout his entire career, and it has been clearly through his time at Matsuda as well. They work very, very hard off the ball. Imagine Daisen Maeda in the Matsuda team. Jeez. And they're very good in the way that Matsuda is very, very good for Maeda is very, very good for Japan. They leave opposition teams very little time to play. They're in your face, not just in small bursts, but the pressing is intense and sustained, which is very hard to do, and you need that strong physical base to be able to do it. They've got this really unusual trick in long throw-ins, which is very effective as well, and they tend to play far more long balls from the back than we see almost any other team in Japan play at all. And they recruited players to fit that system. First of all, their squad is absurd. There's like 400 players in the squad. They've got I think it's double the amount of players compared to any other squad. I don't know how they managed to register them all. But they've got players for every occasion. And the players that they did bring in, you look at someone like Mitch Duke, he was coming back from injury in the Asian Cup and everything else, but he's that perfect kind of player, like intense, unbelievably aggressive, pressing forward off the ball, right? And then you brought in someone like Ose Hoon, who's brilliant for the moments off whatever it is, winning balls and players playing the second ball off him, or indeed just doing what he needs to do from crosses or from balls from deep. They've got the brilliant player Hirakawa on the left wing, who's been part of this Japan Olympic team, has been really good, offers a little bit of creativity. But the thing for me is they bought experienced J-League players, like someone like, Kea Sento and the guy they got from Reds, Shibato. These kind of guys, they've been around and they've been at big clubs, at clubs that have a history of success. Maybe they didn't work out there, but they're still good footballers. And they fit, I think more than any other club, they recruited to fit the precise style of player that the coach wanted, and we don't see that so often in Japan, because there's a disconnect between recruitment being done or driven by a coach and being driven by clubs and backhanders to agents and all this kind of stuff. So I think they recruited perfectly for the way that the coach wants to play. The coach has a clearly defined unusual throwback, not my kind of football, but I think for what he does, he's unbelievably effective at it. And I think there's absolutely no reason whatsoever, I know I made this call about the Tosu 4 or 5 years ago, that they can't go on and win the J-League.
I guess, Johnny, it's just a matter of, how sustainable this is. Scott's referenced the size of the squad. So, they should be able to cover most eventualities when it comes to form and fitness. I mean, of course, their best player, Eric, hasn't featured at all yet. And it might still be a while before we see him. But, the fact that they're top of the pile after 4 games is obviously a massive credit to Go Kuroda, his coaching staff, and the players. I guess how sustainable it is, we'll see in the coming weeks. But, I mean, they're the obvious pick for the most surprising team so far.
Yeah, I think, yeah, as Scott mentioned, especially the attacking players, they do have a lot of players that may on the surface seem quite similar, but they have very different skills. So Mitch Duke's hardly been used so far. So I think he's going to come into his own, especially during if Fujio and Hirakawa are away for like the Asian Under-23 Cup, and then hopefully if Japan make it to the Olympics, they might miss out a bit of time there. And then Eric is due back, I think, after Golden Week at some point, but he's had a very serious injury, so how quickly he gets back up to speed is yet to be seen. And yeah, Na Sang Ho, he played, I think, 20 minutes against Gamba on the opening day, then he got injured. So there are definitely loads of different options. I think, I mean, the squad is so big, I expect to see about 10 of these players going to J2 in the summer. But yeah, it'll be very interesting to see. I think they might bring in a few players in the summer, as they did last season, where that style of football can work for a certain period of time. And then if you change the players, I think it makes it much more difficult the second time round. So, yeah, I think I cover myself in pre-season by saying I have no idea where Machida will finish. So I think I'm covered by that. And then I kind of backed it up by saying they might do something like Oita did a few years ago and start off really well and then maybe kind of drift down, but ultimately finish quite high near the top. I think the other two teams I'd pick out would be Cerezo and Shonan. Cerezo, I think I would expect it to finish somewhere in the top kind of 7 or 8, but their attacking kind of intent in the first few weeks has been very good, like we spoke with Alan last week. I guess my question for them is, you know, a team like Yokohama F. Marinos, if they have a bad result that's caused by over-attacking, they keep to their principles, they keep going. Whereas Cerezo, I wonder with their coach, if they lose a game, like say they lose 3-2 to someone and it comes due to attacking too much, will they keep going if they'll have a painful loss? I think that'll be interesting to see. But if they can get those four Brazilians working, their attack looks very, very good this season. And yeah, Shonan, last season they started off in more attacking fashion and they just ended up getting to too many like slugfests and being outperformed by the opponents. And then sort of had to rein it in towards the back end of last season. And then that game against Urawa just before the international break was absolutely absolute chaos. And they look like if Lukian and Suzuki can continue this partnership, there's goals in this team. And yeah, Tanaka got a goal tonight for the under-23s, and he looked really good in midfield. So I think they'll be an interesting side to watch. What do you make of those two, Scott, Cerezo and Shonan?
Yeah, I think Cerezo are kind of doing what I expected. The interesting thing, because obviously they're trying to get rid of Jordy Krupert. He's come in by necessity through injury. He was exceptional in that last game. So, I don't know. You know, they're 1 point off, you know, whatever they are now, third. But they're 1 win less off, you know, 13th or whatever. But I think they're doing kind of what I expected. Shonan is a curious one. Satoshi Tanaka has turned into a really, really good player. And I think more proactive and more creative, and certainly with more of a goal threat than I ever thought he had. And I don't know how long he'll end up at the club. And I don't know if people know, but I moved down to Fukuoka about a year ago. And the day I moved, I was just walking along the street and I saw a barber. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to go into the barber. And so I went in the barber and I sat down. 30 minutes later, do you know who comes and sits in the chair directly next to me in the barber? It wasn't Satoshi Tanaka.
Daniel Hawkins.
No, it was Luke. It was Lukian. And he's sat there. And he said, I looked up and was like, hey, it's Lukian. And he's like, hey. And his English is actually really, really good. So we spoke, you know, we exchanged, you know, we've stayed in touch and whatever. And he's, he's a really great guy. Literally the first person I met in Fukuoka, except for the barber, was Lukian. And I think he might not be in the Yuki Kakita territory of 20 goals a season. I'm telling you that's happening sometime in the next decade. It's a conversation for another moment. But I think Lukian's a really, really good player. I don't know if he was best utilised as he could during his time down here at Fukuoka. He went to the barber, by the way, before every home game. He got the same hairdo. And he came into the – I still go to the same barber now, and he came in with a signed shirt and it was a lot of business. But I think he's a really, really good player. He showed at J2 level that he can score goals. And it's a kind of good combination with this really promising up-and-coming talent in Akito Suzuki. And I think they work really well together. So if they can hang on to Tanaka, they've mixed up the system as well. I mean, they've been, you know, this kind of three-back team forever. I think the first three games they switched to a back four. Looked pretty good in there. And then the last game, they went back to a three. Okay, so I'm not a fan of doing it in international football, but you've got time to train these kind of shifts week to week in club football. And, you know, if he can match tactically, you know, things for the opponent that week, that's another arrow tactically that they have to their game. And, yeah, I think Luke Yan can score a lot. I think Suzuki will score a lot playing alongside him as well. And if they can hang on to a few of the, and the other young guys that they've got in there as well, you know, Ikeda and Hira Walker are really exciting attacking players. Not sure about the central defensive guys, Allnall and Weaver and these kind of guys, but they've got, yeah, they've got quality going forward. And if Mr. Yamaguchi can keep pushing them to play that way, I think they could do well.
Did you tell Luke Yan you resented all the goals he scored for Avispa against FC Tokyo, Scott?
No. Well, Tokyo got their revenge on that, didn't they? A fortnight ago.
Indeed. Well, yeah. So before we finish up, then, what about Tokyo Verde? Because to me, they're 19th, but they've been a pleasant surprise because they've been in all four of these games, and they probably would have won at least two of them. And yeah, they only have 2 points from four games, but they've far exceeded my expectations, yeah. Especially when you looked at some of these games on paper, you know, playing F Marinos and Reds to name just two examples in the first four match days, haven't looked out of place at all. And as I say, they probably should have more than the 2 points they've got.
They've been good. Like you said, a string, you know, game after game. You can see the players like, Jesus, happening again, these kind of late goals that they conceded. I've done it pretty much with the squad that they came up with as well. I know they brought in the right winger, Fuki Yamada, on loan from Kyoto, and Kai Miki's come in. But there's been no kind of – I'm a really big fan of Itsuki Somono as well, coming loan from Kashima. I know a few clubs were looking to bring him in, on loan or permanently as well. So he's a good player. But, you know, okay, Jofuku has been around the block once or twice. He knows what to do. And, you know, there's nothing, flashy about the football. Not quite much at a level throwback, but, you know, it's an old school kind of 4-4-2 approach with creativity from the wide areas and some kind of forwards that play well off each other. But what they do fairly well. And, again, they haven't come out the same way that Machida in different kind of ways. But, you know, both have come into J1 or back into J1. Looking to play football and looking to play positively, which is a good thing for both. And, yeah, I think both will survive and both will survive fairly comfortably.
I think it's quite interesting as well. Verdi have signed Thiago Alves, the former Yamagata one, not the former Okayama one, and I think from Botafogo in Brazil. So he can play as a kind of second striker or as a winger. And he's been very, very successful for Yamagata goals-wise in J2. Maybe more used as a super sub, but I think he's another string to their bow. So I'm sure he'll do very well for them. And, yeah, I think Verdi were my pick to finish bottom of the league, but they've definitely impressed from that perspective. And, yeah, I think in with a real fighting chance if they keep up this kind of level of performance of staying in the division for next year.
Yes, indeed. And speaking of Verdi, they kick off the match day 5 slate as J1 returns to action after this, abbreviated international break. Verdi host Kyoto on Friday night at Ajinomoto Stadium before the other 9 games for the match day are all played on Saturday afternoon. So, as is customary round here, Johnny, please provide us with your pick of the match day.
Johnny's pick of the match day.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to go into two of the teams I just mentioned for positive reasons are playing each other in South Osaka this Saturday, and that's Cerezo against Shonan. I think for a neutral or someone just getting into J-League, I think there'll be goals in this game. It's two sides have looked very attacking in the first few weeks of the season. And I think, last season Shonan went to Cerezo really needing a result towards the back end of the season, and they grabbed a 2-0 victory. So I'm sure Cerezo will have the bit between their teeth to get revenge in Shonan there. So I think for a neutral and looking for excitement, that would be the game to go for. The other one I would mention was obviously Sanfrecce at home to Gamba. That's at 1 o'clock on Saturday. Gamba did spoil the party for Sanfrecce. They won a pre-season game and the official opening of the beautiful new stadium in Hiroshima. So I'm sure, again, Hiroshima, they'll be looking to get their title challenge, get geared up to the max. So it'll be a very tough game for Gamba, but it's also a game where Sanfrecce could drop points, and that would be They've dropped points in two of their four games. They wouldn't want to make it three out of five, but very, very tight game there. So, yeah, I'm going to pick both games involving Osaka clubs, maybe not so surprisingly, but for different reasons, those two stick out for me. What about yourself, Scott? What game would you pick, or games?
Well, I think if you're a neutral looking for goals and excitement, you can't go past the 11-goal thriller that Kawasaki and FC Tokyo are going to play out. This could, this could literally be anything. It could be the highest scoring J-League game of all time. Yeah, I mean, defensively, obviously, both teams have got concerns and issues, and both teams just want to go forward and score goals. Yeah, I'm not exaggerating. I think this could be the highest scoring J-League game in history. I think it's going to be a great game. Whatever it's called. Aside from that, Machida up against Tosu. See if they can keep the run going. Nagoya against Marinos should be good. I'm not so sure that how things will unfold for Marinos as the year progresses, but they've certainly started pretty good for now. Nagoya in need of a turnaround there as well. But I think if you're a neutral looking for entertainment, surely Kawasaki and Tokyo is the game.
Yeah, well, you've picked it up. So hopefully for you and I as Tokyo supporters, the Gasmen come out on the right end of that result. But, we shall see. Beware a wounded Kawasaki heading into a Classico. Just a quick mention for another game. An all top half clash at the Big Swan when Niigata host Kashiwa, two teams who have enjoyed decent starts to the season, and hopefully for the neutrals who watch that game at 2 o'clock on Saturday, it's an entertaining one, and maybe your Takumi can get his first goal of the season. Yes, Scott.
Yes, I'm not sure about this. He looks like that little Buddhist statue for kids. What's that called? Jizo, what's that thing called? That's what Komi looks like with this buzz cut now. But that wasn't the point I was going to make. The point I was going to make is you've been doing this for a long time. Have you ever seen a guy like this character Matsuhashi at Niigata who is rotating his team like weekly? I mean, it's not like rotating it between, if there's a cup game here or whatever. The guy is just constantly I've been covering football for a long time all around the world, and I've never seen any coach in a league do what he does. One centre-back is in here, the next week one's in. The central midfielder is here, it's this guy, it's the next one. The striker is this, the left winger. I've never seen anything like it. In your time in the J-League, I'm guessing you haven't either.
No, I haven't. I can't confess to be over each and every member of the Niigata starting lineup each and every week to check who's in and out. But
Johnny is. I'll put that question to Johnny. It's bizarre, man. It's like literally like you don't know if you're the one time the right back is this guy, one time the left back is this guy, one time the central panel is this is central. But it's week on week, constant rotation.
Yeah, I think it's almost like the 2020 season when teams were playing every 3 or 4 days. Everyone constantly rotated. He's basically playing.
He's still got long-term COVID. That's what it is.
I put in my notes in Niigata last week that he'd only made one change, and that was surprising news.
There we go. He's seen the error of his ways. All right, then. So we'll leave it there. A terrific round of J1 action in prospect over this weekend, and then we double up with a match day 6 the following Wednesday. And I'm pleased to report, listeners, that I'll be your faithful correspondent at the National Stadium for FC Tokyo versus Urawa. Looking forward to that. Getting along to my first game of the season in next midweek. But for now, we will leave this episode of the pod there, and thank you ever so much for joining us, Scott. Hope this wasn't too long for you, but we very much appreciate your thoughts on the
national
team.
We've done it in an hour. I'm buzzing.
Under an hour. So, yes, your influence has paid off, and we appreciate you joining us, and we hope to catch up with you again soon.
Great to be with you guys.
All right, then. We'll leave it there, Johnny. Looking forward to J1 returning to action, and I'll speak to you next week.
Yeah, but I've enjoyed my little rest. I'm pumped up for the 3-day match week we've got coming up. And, I'm looking forward to speaking to you next week. Thanks very much.
Cheers, Johnny. All right, then. So thanks to Scott. Thanks to our patrons. And thanks to you, listeners, for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to review J1 Match Day 5. Speak to you then. Bye for now. Minamino?
No.
Tanaka?
No.
Mm.
Yuki Kakita.
Tremendous.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.